welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Friday, March 14th, 2025. Western Equatoria officials say they've made arrests in connection with a string of recent attacks.
There are criminals in Yambio who are now trying to create problems by burning people's houses, targeting it at midnight. And the good thing is, I need to announce that we have started to arrest them.
And the United Nations spokesperson makes an urgent plea for help in Sudan as the war there rages on.
Aid groups are telling us that more than 70% of 1,400 community kitchens in Sudan have ceased operations due to lack of funds, including in areas that are facing famine.
These stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Western Equatoria state authorities say they have arrested several suspects, including some teenagers, in Yambio for alleged looting and home arson attacks. Acting Governor Daniel Bagdagbu Ribasa, who says security forces have launched an operation to arrest suspects, are responsible for crimes committed in Yambio during a wave of attacks over the past 3 weeks. Matia Samuel Tamatio reports from Yambio.
In late February and earlier this month, Yambio, the capital of Western Equatoria State, experienced a spate of violence, gunfire, looting, and arson attacks on homes. Residents of Yambio County repeatedly called for authorities to beef up security. Western Equatoria State Acting Governor Daniel Badabu says security forces have arrested some suspects and will continue to hunt for others behind the criminal activity. He, however, did not specify the number of the suspects arrested.
I know there are criminals in Yambio who are now trying to create problems by burning people's houses, targeting it at midnight. And the good thing is, I need to announce that we have started to arrest them. Some of them are young children who are below the age, and if they are being used, we will investigate them to see why they target some houses, and some criminals who are behind this will be apprehended.
Badagbu encourages neighborhoods to work with police to provide tips that can lead to the arrest of more suspected criminals.
We need the community members to also participate equally in the protection of security in terms of early warning. Now we are going to engage vigorously in a community policing initiative in all residential areas to make sure that we curb insecurity that befell our people. We will actually reinforce this to build trust between law enforcement and the local population.
One man tells VOA his home in Yambio was attacked and set on fire, identifying himself only as Paul. For fear the attackers would retaliate, he says the government must do more to bring criminals to justice.
I need our acting governor to work hard so that they can also stop this rampant burning of houses in Western Equatoria. Because when something happens like this, sometimes people will also condemn the government of Western Equatoria that they are not working. That's why this use of rampant shooting and rampant burning of houses is happening in Western Equatoria State. We wanted to concentrate on our garden. We need our children to go to the school with this economic plus the higher inflation in the Republic of South Sudan.
Victor Mbengo Katasi is the state coordinator for the Community Empowerment for Progress Organization. He says it's time state authorities to ensure for victims that justice is served and is meted out quickly.
We really call for these perpetrators to be brought to book and justice should prevail. We really don't feel when perpetrators are brought to book and they are just left to go like that. One thing that is happening is when somebody is apprehended for any offense that he or she has committed, taken even to the police, you see that after 2 or 3 days, the person is again on the road moving. There we really want to call for justice to prevail.
Even though a known number of arrests were made according to officials, the state authority announced that unknown criminals set ablaze 9 more houses in the Yambio neighborhood of Akoroboji. For VOA News, I am Matia Samuel Timatio, reporting from Western Equatoria State Capital, Yambio.
The United Nations is sending out an urgent plea for the people of Sudan, where more than 2 years of war have left much of the population displaced and facing severe hunger. UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric yesterday described the situation to journalists at UN headquarters in New York.
Our humanitarian colleagues are yet again sounding the alarm because funding shortages are forcing the closure of community kitchens, which, as you can imagine, serve as a lifeline for millions of people across the country. Aid groups are telling us that more than 70% of 1,400 community kitchens in Sudan have ceased operations due to lack of funds, including in areas that are facing famine.
Dujarric says a striking example of what is happening is in one of the largest displacement camps in the region, the Zamzam camp in El Fasher of North Darfur.
The camp is one of the locations where famine was confirmed last year. Our humanitarian colleagues tell us that the camp is estimated to be hosting some 500,000 displaced people. Severe food shortages have forced families there to consume animal feed just to survive. Our partners say that stocks of essential medicine and therapeutic foods have already run out, leading to rising level of malnutrition. Medical supplies in the camp's mobile clinics are also running out.
Meanwhile, Dujarric says near constant shelling in the area has put families at even greater risk.
It made our humanitarian access nearly impossible. Across many parts of the country, these aid groups provide food, they provide basic health care and other critical support. Without them, hundreds of thousands of people are at increased risk of severe hunger. The budget required to sustain these kitchens and other essential frontline services provided at the community level is estimated at $12 million per month. We renew our call for an immediate de-escalation so that civilians can reach life-saving assistance they need. As local health authorities in El Fasher have said, stopping the hostilities is the only real solution to addressing the region's worsening health crisis.
Dujarric again called for unimpeded access to those in need and for additional resources to scale up response efforts. He also called on the international community to act now to prevent further disruptions to humanitarian support. Leaders with the United People's Alliance, or UPA, are condemning the decision by the government of South Sudan to invite the Uganda People's Defense Forces to South Sudan in a bid to lower tensions after a string of deadly attacks in Upper Nile, Western Bahar Ghazal, and Western Equatoria states. The UPA is an umbrella group of the South Sudan Opposition Movements Alliance and other opposition groups taking part in the Kenya-mediated Tumani Initiative peace talks in Nairobi. The alliance brought their forces under one command, headed by General Pagan Amu-Makech. A press release signed by the UPA Secretary General and official spokesperson, Luol Dao, yesterday says South Sudan is at a critical junction where the people are rising up in order to rescue the country from the current economic, humanitarian, and political crisis, and that the mismanagement and looting of national resources orchestrated by the cartels that is dominating the government of South Sudan continues. The statement goes on to say that unlike in other countries where governments value the well-being and security of their citizens, the ruling clique in Juba, masquerading as a government, has once again demonstrated that returning the country to war is intentional. And it says, therefore, inviting foreign troops into South Sudan is a premeditated, malicious plan to return the country to a full-out war, end quote. President Salva Kiir recently told citizens that he will not allow the country to return to civil war. The UPA is calling for the immediate withdrawal of all foreign troops from South Sudan, not mandated by the United Nations. It is Women's History Month, and we have been bringing you stories about women in South Sudan all month long. Today, we've got a story for you about women helping women in Eastern Equatoria State. Women there are supporting each other to enhance growth in their communities. Clementina Itwari Francis, chairperson of the Torrett County Women's Association there, says women are facing challenges every day that have to do with harmful cultural traditions that oppress their rights, deny girls education in some areas, and early and forced marriages that have motivated her to empower women in the state. Kaltuma Vanessa has more for VOA from Torrett.
Clementina Ituari Francis was the first girl in her village to finish senior secondary school. After leaving, she took a job in the local government as a clerk in Torit County, where she met other women and determined that they often are oppressed in the name of culture. She decided then she wanted to help create change for women. Now, Ituari is the chairperson of the Torit County Women's Association and executive director of the women's group ONU, advocating for women's right. Ituari spent some of her school years in Uganda, where she said she learned the importance of group association, especially for women.
When we came here in Torit, there was no any group that women can come together and make their own things. So I started also looking at it now. What do I do? With the knowledge that I have for the importance of women coming together, I need to form a women group. Seven of us came together. I told them now we cannot just be seated, and it's important for women to always come together. The women association was formed. The executive body was elected. The commissioner also helped us with the space, gave us the land, and we started our activity there. And the activities that we are doing up to now is making bed seeds, making beads, and making this food processing, and the whole income is to support the women in their own families.
Ituari says that church activities and her education motivated her. She was inspired to join when the Norwegian Church Aid Organization formed women's group to help them in agriculture, and she helped start a village saving and loan group to help women get the funds they need to start businesses and care for families.
We started this VSLA where you put something. Every week you give whether 5 or 2,000, 3, we put together. And in December, we opened the box. The women went with the money and they were able to provide everything for their family, especially for the children, clothes for them to celebrate. Now it has motivated other women to come in, and now others who are not part became part of the VSLA group now, which is a motivating factor for me, who is really struggling, trying to see that women always keep coming together to support one another.
Ituari says many women in some communities in South Sudan are not given a platform to contribute and express their opinions, but their ideas can bring peace and development if they are given the chance. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Eastern Equatorial State Capital, Torit.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, U.S. lawmakers face a looming deadline to prevent a government shutdown. Will it be averted? We'll have a live report. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The Trump administration is considering downsizing U.S. Africa Command, led by General Michael Langley, as part of its broader efforts to reduce the size of the Pentagon. The move involves making AFRICOM a subcommand of European Command. Supporters contend that moving AFRICOM into EUCOM would help simplify command structures and cut down on bureaucracy. However, opponents argue that this would diminish U.S. military influence in Africa, creating a space that could be filled by Russia and China. David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, discusses the merits of this idea with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
I think there is something to be said there. Africa Command has never really reached its full potential. The theory behind the establishment of Africa Command was that Africa had been neglected previously when it was part of European Command, and that by having a standalone command, they would be able to have a continual engagement. The problem is there was no plus up in the personnel assigned to Africa Command, and there really isn't the demand for persistence presence in Africa that we had anticipated. So what you wound up seeing was that most of the subcomponents, like the air command, they just folded it in the European command. The naval command folded it in the European command. And you wound up, instead of getting a really strong interagency presence at Africa command, it never quite fit in. So you didn't get the best and the brightest from other agencies that the Department of Defense had hoped for. And it was always a little submanned, undermanned. I think that you can make the case that if you keep maybe a 4-star billet dedicated to Africa and maybe 30-man cell at European Command dedicated solely to African affairs, you could probably have an engagement with Africa on a similar level without having an entire headquarters and the overhead that comes with it.
But opponents argue that this would diminish U.S. military influence in Africa, creating a space that could be filled by Russia and China.
Well, it might have been valid a few years ago, but what we've seen is while Africa Command has been established and presumably in full force, the United States has been replaced by Russia and Burkina Faso, but the West and the United States in Niger, in Mali, and the French have been pretty much ejected from Chad. These are all countries that were key to our Sahel capability. The presence of the U.S. in Africa is usually limited to African Lion. That's a series of exercises that predated the establishment of Africa Command. So it's kind of hard to, you know, the bad things are happening with Africa Command and some of the good things happened without Africa Command. So it's hard to make the case that Africa Command is as important as advocates argue. That being said, Africa still remains important. The question is whether you can achieve our desired effect without having a dedicated 4-star command. And I think I'm sympathetic to the idea that you can.
But following the U.S. withdrawal of its forces in Africa, then France on Friday began handing over military bases in Senegal as part of a withdrawal of troops from the West African nation, where it has had a presence since 1960. And this withdrawal follows the departure of French forces from Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, and Ivory Coast in recent years. How would that impact the counterterrorism efforts in Africa?
The counterterrorism efforts in Africa are not satisfactory by any means. I mean, it has been steadily declining. And what we've seen is that countries that had been partners, as you noted, are ejecting France, which was the key player in the Sahel in the United States, which was a key supporting player. So it's going to be impacted, but it's already on a downward trajectory with Africa Command. So the question is, what would the expense of a dedicated 4-star headquarters, which has to have an inspector general or a staff judge advocate and, you know, an entire staff, what would that command, given that it couldn't stop the trajectory, couldn't we do it just by having a sub-command that doesn't require all the overhead, but could conduct continual engagement? How much of a drop-off would there be? And I would argue that the drop-off will not be that much, that you could maintain the same level of performance, but with less overhead.
That is David DeRoche. He is associate professor at the National Defense University. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi. United States lawmakers are entering into the final full day before a government shutdown, which is expected to shutter critical federal agencies and furlough thousands of civil servants. VOA's Anthony Labruto joins us live now here in Washington, D.C. at the U.S. Capitol with a look into what lawmakers are saying will need to happen in order to keep federal funding from lapsing. Anthony, thanks for joining us. What happens during a government shutdown, first of all? Oh, we're going to come back to Anthony in just a little bit. He's getting himself ready. We're going to bring you another story right now instead. Botswana has made $4 million from the sale of licenses to hunt wild animals, the highest figure since lifting a hunting ban in 2019. The hunting season, which ended in November, was held amid growing opposition from some European countries that want a ban on the importation of African wildlife trophies. From Gaborone, Mokondisi Dube reports.
Botswana issues around 400 elephant licenses annually, with most purchased by overseas hunters. Winter Mulotsi, Minister of Environment and Tourism, told Parliament Thursday that millions of dollars were generated through the sale of mostly elephant licenses in villages in wildlife areas.
In order to manage the wildlife population, the country is implementing a combination of both consumptive and non-consumptive utilization of wildlife resources to derive optimum economic benefit, particularly for our communities. For the 2024 hunting season, the community quotas generated the sum of 42,863,423 pula. Further, a total of 15,633,950 pula was realized from the sale of special elephant quotas to support elephant conservation and community-led projects within the elephant range.
In 2023, Botswana earned $2.7 million from hunting licenses. Mulutsi, however, says the hunts face increasing Western opposition. Canada and Belgium are among countries that have recently banned importation of wildlife trophies.
The country is facing opposition from animal rights organizations to our policy of sustainable wildlife utilization using hunting as a management tool and empowerment to local communities. The ministry, working with the hunting industry and affected community trust, stepped up efforts to counter this growing opposition to sustainable hunting through engagements carried out in the UK and Germany.
Sioka Simasiku, director at the Conservation Coalition, Gamiland Council of Non-Governmental Organizations, says communities will be the hardest hit if the UK imposes restrictions. He has been to Europe to campaign against trophy import bans.
The UK ban, it's going to be bad on community benefits. One, because UK is a superpower. It might actually be able to influence other countries to actually follow suit. And then the communities might actually lose the market that already exists, as more hunters would not actually be coming towards Botswana to hunt in community concessions due to the trophy bans.
Why is the Nawa of the Elephant Protection Society among those who want the hunts to be stopped? He also argues revenue accrued from hunting does not significantly benefit Botswana nationals.
They are giving us the figures of money that they make from hunting. But also, let's look at the compensation that they also compensate people. And also, the result of hunting. What does the hunting bring in the local people? Because, or the animals that experience hunting, they tend to change their behavior and they are killing people. That's why we said there should be a proper research on that regard.
Botswana, with the world's largest elephant herd at more than 130,000 elephants, has recorded an increase in human fatalities while crops are damaged. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
American lawmakers are heading into the final day before a government shutdown, which is expected to shutter a whole lot of federal agencies and furlough thousands of civil servants. VOA's Anthony Labruto is joining us live here in Washington, D.C., at the U.S. Capitol with a look into what lawmakers are saying right now and what they'll need to happen in order to keep federal funding from lapsing. Thanks first for joining us, Anthony. And if you can just kind of explain what happens during a government shutdown.
Absolutely, Carol. Good to be with you. So a shutdown involves United States federal lawmakers not being able to pass a bill or a national budget. And so what this will involve is now that could be entering into a shutdown territory, agencies are now preparing to potentially furlough thousands of workers. But really what will happen is that the appropriated funds will run out at midnight tonight, meaning that these agencies cannot carry out a lot of these critical missions. So really, after the United States government shuts down potentially at midnight tonight, federal agencies will begin operating at a reduced capacity. Some of them will, but the majority of them, a lot of these federal workers, will be told they can no longer work and will be sent home until the shutdown concludes.
Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was pivotal in getting enough fellow Democrats to join Republicans in voting for this CR to avert a government shutdown. As you know, even though he called it a terrible bill, outsiders might not understand that. Can you explain Schumer's rationale for voting for the Republican plan and urging others to do that on his side that cuts funding for many government agencies?
Absolutely. So Schumer had indicated at a private meeting in just outside of Washington, D.C. in Virginia just yesterday that he would intend to vote yes on an important bill. So really what that was trying to do was signal that as the Democratic leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate, that this would allow more Democrats to potentially join him. But actually, a number of them really have seemed to have gone against. You know, we remember just a couple of days ago that in the House of Representatives, the Democratic lawmakers really were calling on their Democratic colleagues in the Senate to oppose oppose this bill. One Democrat, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, really called this potentially a betrayal of the Democratic Party in the House and to those that had won in the district that Donald Trump had won in that 2024 election. So barring just one, every single member in the Democratic House had voted against this bill. And now coming out, it really felt like that of a betrayal. And so that opposition, really that stark opposition from the Democrats in the House, really puts a lot of pressure on the Democrats in the Senate here. Now, it's an incredibly difficult position, I should say, not just amongst their own party, but within the halls of government, but each other, their constituencies. And what are their constituencies looking out of this bill that if they vote yes, if they vote no, they need eight votes to really to continue that continuing resolution to advance into that 60-vote threshold to actually pass it into law.
But isn't it true that Schumer felt that, you know, if they vote for the shutdown, in other words, they don't give the Republicans the votes they need, then, you know, things could be even way worse for Americans in general and especially for federal workers and others because they could have more power, right?
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of worries of the Democratic Party really were that if the government shuts down, if those eight Democrats don't vote for that bill, which is coming up in a couple of hours, about 1:15 local time, it's going to really put a lot more opportunity really in Donald Trump's hands and a lot more congressional Republicans' hands to really dictate a lot more federal policy regarding a lot of these federal workers. I mean, we're already seeing a lot of reductions in force in part from the government, the Department of Government Efficiency, and potentially shutting down the government and furloughing a lot of these workers may potentially give a lot more ground for a lot of these congressional appropriators to look for further cuts and making negotiation really with the Democrats that much more difficult.
That is VOA's Anthony Labruto speaking with us live from Capitol Hill. Thanks, Anthony. It's time for our weekly segment called Listener Comments, where we hear what you have to say about what's in the news. Giet Gabriel Atem in Juba says the political situation in South Sudan is unpredictable because our political classes lack political will. I am asking our civil population to come together, to be united and see themselves as one, put their tribes aside. We fought the good fight with very strong unity. Now, we very much need to do that exercise again to make South Sudan a great nation once again. Kinambori Christopher in Juba County says, hello, South Sudan in Focus at the Voice of America. I just wanted to extend my warmest greetings to you. Please also pass my heartfelt regards to my wife, Minasari Jackie, my children, Gijibidi Gnoel, Naya Kamba Nolan, and my friends, Michael Franco, Pate Solomon, and Jackson Gimme, wishing you all good health, happiness, and blessings. Dior Bacheng from Yirol of Lake State says, good evening. I'm appealing to all South Sudanese who are using social media to preach an end to hatred and preach unity for all of us. Well, that wraps it up for us this Friday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow miss this broadcast, just head over to voaafrica.com/South Sudan. And VOA Africa is now available on WhatsApp to share your input on our broadcasts, including sending us your listener comments or to receive our daily news updates. Text us on +1 202-322-7510. You can also follow our WhatsApp channel by searching for our username, VOA Africa. We now leave you with the song Mocristo by the late Papa Wemba and VLM. Listening to the song Mocristo by the late Papa Wemba and VLM. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Patrick Dea, producer Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. Have a peaceful weekend, everybody, and we'll talk with you again on Monday evening on another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.